And I have under strict instructions from Dan not to touch anything. So if you see me raise my hand, just do something. Okay, it really is good to see all of you. And we are in, you may know, we are in our second week of Lent. And Lent is a liturgical season like Advent. And we do have a custom here to use art and images to help us reflect during this season. So it's just a small bit. And I'm doing it a little bit differently. I'm kind of going to weave it a little bit through the message, but here we go. This term liturgy that we're using a lot lately derives from the Greek words for both people and work. I did study ancient Greek for a while, and I didn't know this, that liturgy. And I tried to find this to make sure it was true, but I'm going to start. I normally have one cup of coffee in the morning. I had more than one this morning. I'm going to breathe for a minute here. The word liturgy encompasses the work of a community, as well as the prayers, the meditations, and the rituals that shape us as we gather together as the people of God. And so as we walk through this season of Lent together, we're taking a few moments each week to participate together in liturgies for resisting empire, much as the Old Testament did in their work. And we hope that what you're going to hear and see helps to collectively tune our hearts to the heartbeat of God and the prophetic work that our present age requires. Now, to clarify, we're using this word empire. By the word empire, we mean any political, economic, religious, and I might add even family system that requires power and fear and exploitation of others in order to exist. And there are many systems like this in the world today. And as we see throughout history and even in our present day, this way of empire inevitably leads to domination, division, isolation, and exclusion, rather than shared belonging, flourishing, and the peace or shalom that the kingdom of God creates. So the prayers you're going to hear during, kind of woven through today, were written by the Cuban-American author and theologian Kat Armas. And I'll give a brief invocation, and then there'll be some words on the screen in bold that I'd like us to be able to read together. And we're also going to see an image and have a few moments of silence. So here's our invocation. Wellspring of truth, may your wild edges unravel what we thought we knew. Where beauty and terror breathe as one, you invite us to stay and not turn away, to witness your mystery in all that is both glorious and undone. And together we say, we reject the lies that we are sold ourselves about the world. We reclaim the truth that has been buried beneath their weight. There's something wonderful about speaking in unison, and I was actually very moved this morning for that first worship song to hear our voices in unison together. It's a beautiful, beautiful sound. Thank you. Well, we're going to have a reflection today, and I'm going to tell you a story, and it's a story you know well. It was written by Hans Christian Andersen, and it's a story about an emperor. So here we go. Once there was an emperor obsessed with fine clothes. Two swindlers came to his court, claiming they could weave a fabric so exquisite that it would be invisible to anyone who was foolish. Intrigued, the emperor paid them handsomely to create an outfit from this magical fabric. The weavers worked at empty looms, pretending to weave. When the emperor's officials went to check on the progress, they saw nothing, but feared admitting that, thinking that doing so would reveal their incompetence. So they praised the invisible fabric. The emperor, also seeing nothing, went along with the deception to avoid looking foolish. The emperor decided to wear the clothes in a grand parade. As he walked through the streets, no one in the crowd dared to admit that they saw nothing. Then a child in the crowd, unburdened by fear or pride, shouted, "But he's not wearing anything at all." The crowd murmured in agreement, and soon everyone saw the truth. Embarrassed, but too proud to stop, the emperor continued his parade, knowing he had been exposed. So I want you to look at this next image. Yes. This image was created by a Turkish artist. His name is Ugar Galekuş. And I just want you to spend a couple minutes thinking about how did this image connect to the fable you just heard? And how might this image connect to the role of Old Testament prophets? I'll be back up in a minute. And now I invite you to say, for us to say together these words. For the times we have failed to see reality for what it is, open our hearts, O God. Thank you. So this, we're jumping into the first official Sunday of a series, The Tears of Things. And Andrew created this series. He helped work on this liturgy that you're seeing. And he also kind of gave us a brief opening to the series last Sunday during a contemplative his contemplative service. So why are we studying the prophets? Well, the prophets played an important role in the Old Testament, and they also play an important role today, or they can or could play an important role today if we did listen to the prophets. Prophets, ancient and modern, all have similar characteristics. Prophets are divine messengers, and I don't mean that they're messengers, that they're divine, but they are messengers from God. They speak the words that God has given them. They're not free spirits in a way, and they're not even original thinkers, but what they are is faithful. They faithfully do and say what God has asked them to do and say, sometimes against their will, like Jonah, who didn't want to do any of it. There is also an aspect of performance to prophets. There are elements of theater in their writings. There are elements and in their actions. There are elements of theater and rhetoric in the text. And some prophets, notably Hosea and Isaiah, acted and lived in dramatic ways to reinforce the message that they were bringing. Hosea married a prostitute in order to give a visual example of what it was like to be God married to unfaithful Israel. Isaiah walked naked and barefoot for 3 years, and I'm really looking forward to the teacher who does Isaiah, because I would like to know why he thought he had to do that. Prophets are also a moral conscience of the people. They call people to repentance and to ethical living. They are visionaries, both in that they see visions and that they communicate what visions of the future. They warn of consequences for disobedience. They offer hope for redemption. And in the book, The Tears of Things by Richard Rohr, which we're also using as a text for this series, the author speaks of prophets as an early warning system, a heads up from God. Things are going to change. Prophets are great social critics. Many of the prophets, and there are modern day prophets, and I'm going to mention a couple later on, but prophets challenge societal norms and injustices, and they advocate for the marginalized and the oppressed. The downside of being a prophet is there's a lot of personal sacrifice. Prophets frequently endure personal suffering and persecution for their commitment to their calling. jailed, beaten, killed, like Zechariah, Jeremiah, and Isaiah, and modern-day prophets. Which is why, again, so many of the prophets beg God, please, I do not want to be a prophet. But they also have played a very important covenantal role. They reinforced the covenant relationship between God and his people, reminding the people of their responsibilities. So I'm 70 years old, and I managed to get through most of my life without reading the prophets. The major and the minor prophets, books of the prophets, have always been the weird books in the Bible, the scary books, the God is mean books, although I have always enjoyed the book of Jonah. Even Martin Luther, the great reformer of the church in the 1500s, found the prophetic books difficult to comprehend. So I was a bit nervous about today's message, but fortunately I was assigned Amos, which is one of the shorter prophetic books, and Amos is actually a really good entry point to the role of the prophets. Amos, in his book, self-describes himself as a shepherd and also a tender of trees, primarily fig trees. He pruned and harvested the fig trees. He lived during the time of a divided Israel. There were two kingdoms in his life, a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom known as Judah. And Amos lived in the southern kingdom in the 700s BC. And during this time, Uzziah was king of Judah. So southern kingdom was two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. The northern kingdom was the other 10. In the northern kingdom, during this time, Jeroboam II was king. And under Jeroboam II, the northern kingdom prospered. It had much more political clout than the southern kingdom, much more wealth. The two words you would use to describe the northern kingdom would be power and prosperity, but also a third word, idolatry. Because Jeroboam II continued what earlier northern kings had started, which was the worship of foreign gods and goddesses. And he built a shrine to the worship of, more than one, to the worship of foreign gods and goddesses. And all in all, in the northern kingdom, it was a time of extravagant indulgences, luxurious living, immorality, corruption of the judicial system, and oppression of the poor and marginalized. And I'll just let us all take a beat right there. Which are the very things that Amos addresses and calls out. It is believed that Amos was one of the first prophets, and some believe he served as a model for later prophets. One of the reasons, actually the main reason, that his writings were preserved by later Jewish scholars is that what he said would happen did indeed happen. But just to clarify, prophets are not fortune tellers. They are not predictors of the future. They are speaking on behalf of God. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the Old Testament prophets is that they say only what God told them to say. What they are is faithful, faithfully doing what God has asked them to do and paying a high price for it. Now, as I said, Amos lived in Judah, in the southern kingdom. However, his words are aimed at Israel in the northern kingdom. Good job. You can see how much bigger northern kingdom is. Amos just went across the border to Bethel. So you see how it's really close to the area? And that's the place that Jeroboam built as a shrine to other gods and goddesses. So Amos says in the beginning of his book, the message of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, that he received on behalf of Israel. It came to him in visions during the time that Uzziah was king of Judah and Jeroboam II, son of Joash, was king of Israel, 2 years before the big earthquake. God roars from Zion, shouts from Jerusalem. The thunderclap voice withers the pastures tended by shepherds, Mount Carmel's proud peak. Basically, sit up and listen, everybody, is what Amos is saying. And chapters 1 and 2. Now, it's going to sound like we're going to go through the whole thing verse by verse, but we're not. I'm going to do some big leaps through it. But in the beginning, I do have a lot of verses. So Amos, after he does his, hey, listen up, verses, starts off by saying this. Because of the three great sins of Damascus, make that four, and I'm going to read more than this on the screen, I'm not putting up with her any longer. She pounded Gilead to a pulp, pounded her senseless with iron hammers and mauls, and for that I'm setting the palace of Hazael on fire, I'm torching Ben-Hadad's forts, I'm going to smash the Damascus gates and banish the crime king who lives in Sin Valley, the vice boss who gives orders from Paradise Palace. The people of the land will be sent back to where they came from. Thus saith the Lord. Now, Amos does that over and over again. He started with Damascus, and then he's going to do the same thing through Gaza, Tyre, Edom. I'm going to cover these later. Tells what they did wrong, and then tells them the punishment that they're going to receive. But I just want to talk a little bit about that little phrase. Because of the three great sins of, make that four. What does that verse mean? Because he repeats it over and over again every time he comes to a different land. And basically what it is, it just shows how intense their transgressions are. The phrase underscores that the sins of these nations and of Judah and Israel have reached a fullness that God can no longer overlook. Though the sins are listed individually, the idiom conveys the totality of their guilt. The image is one of piling one offense on time of another offense and emphasizing that judgment is merited. Am I talking at like 110 words a minute? Because I feel I'm okay. Okay, thank you, Andrew. And this phrase, because of three sins, even four, it's a deliberate literary device. When you repeat something over and over, that happens a lot in Hebrew poetry and Hebrew wisdom literature. These formulas catch the listener's ear, the reader's attention, and they drive home the point that God's judgments are neither haphazard nor rash. Instead, they show that God is fully aware of each nation's cumulative guilt and passes judgment only after unwavering patience. Now, I just want to show you a cool thing that I think Amos did. He started at Gaza, the lower left of Judah, and he calls out Gaza first. Now remember, he's standing in Israel at the shrine of the gods and goddesses, and he's talking to the people. He calls out Gaza, and he calls out the Philistines, and then he moves up, and he calls up above Northern Kingdom. He calls out Tyre. He calls out Phoenicia. He calls out Aram. Comes down over here. He calls out Ammon. Ammon are the descendants of Lot. Calls out Moab. Moab are some more of Lot's descendants. Edom down here, that's Jacob's brother Esau, their descendants. And I can just see the people at Bethel listening to Amos call out all these other nations going, preach it, brother. Yeah, those guys are bad. Because those are their enemies, or at least the people they've chosen not to like. And then Amos does a weird thing. Then his next one is he calls out Judah. Now, he's from Judah. He calls them out. And I can see the Israelites going, whoa. And then going, that's a little close to home. And then, so now you see that Amos has just drawn a big circle around Israel by calling out these nations. And guess what? Guess who's next? He hits Israel, and he hits Israel hard. It's the longest section of all the little sections he's been doing. Because of the three great sins of Israel, make that four, I'm not putting up with them any longer. They buy and sell upstanding people. People for them are only things, ways of making money. They'd sell a poor man for a pair of shoes. They'd sell their own grandmother. They grind the penniless into the dirt, shove the luckless into the ditch. Everyone and his brother sleeps with the sacred whore. Those are the goddesses that Jeroboam introduced. A sacrilege against my holy name. Stuff they've extorted from the poor is piled up at the shrine of their god while they sit around drinking wine they've conned from their victims. In contrast, I was always on your side. I destroyed the Amorites who confronted you. Amorites with the stature of great cedars, tough as thick oaks. I destroyed them from the top branches down. I destroyed them from the roots up. And yes, I'm the one who delivered you from Egypt, led you safely through the wilderness for 40 years, and then handed you the country of the Amorites like a piece of cake on a platter. I raised up some of your young men to be prophets. Set aside your best youth for training in holiness. Isn't this so, Israel? Thus saith the Lord, God's decree. But you made the youth in training break training, and you told the young prophets, don't prophesy. And then God is complaining about himself here. You're too much for me. I'm hard pressed to the breaking point. I'm like a wagon piled high and overloaded, creaking and groaning. When I go into action, when God goes into action, what will you do? There's no place to run, no matter how fast you run. The strength of the strong won't count. Fighters won't make it. Skilled archers won't make it. Fast runners won't make it. Chariot drivers won't make it. Even the bravest of your warriors won't make it. He'll run off for dear life, stripped naked. Everything they've put their trust in, everything they put their trust in, will disappear. Wow. In the next chapter, in chapter 3, and I do encourage you to go home and read Amos because it's interesting. But think of chapter 3 when you go home and read it as a courtroom scene now. And Amos is the prosecuting attorney. And he's just accused Israel of a whole bunch of crimes. And now he's reminding Israel that cause and effect are part of the natural order. He says, does a lion roar when there's no prey? Does a bird become trapped if there isn't a snare set up? When a trumpet sounds in the city, doesn't it cause people to tremble? When God chose Israel, didn't he require their faithfulness? God chose Israel. They have a kind of covenant. Israel broke the covenant. What Israel has done will cause God to act. Israel had a great calling, which came with great responsibility, and so their sin and rebellion brings great consequence, warns Amos. And Amos, even in chapter 3, invites the Philistine nation and Egypt to witness what happens to nations that hoard wealth and disregard the needs of people. He's giving even the pagan nations a warning. And then we have God kind of appearing as a judge in this courtroom scene to describe the punishment he will inflict, and it's bad. The northern kingdom is going to be completely overrun by an enemy, will go into exile, and hardly anything will survive. And guess what? Israel argues with God. God, if we had known you were going to punish us, we wouldn't have turned away from you. You should have given us a warning. And then God speaks again. Remember when this bad thing happened? Remember when that bad thing happened? Do you remember when that bad thing happened? Those were your warnings. And then in chapters 4 and 5, Amos calls out the Israelites for their complacency, their indifference to the poor. And he exposes the religious hypocrisy of Israel's wealthy and of their leaders. He describes how the religious leaders, the secular leaders, faithfully attend the religious gatherings, giving offerings and sacrifices, all the while neglecting the poor and ignoring the injustice that happens in the kingdom. And Amos says it's all a sham, that God actually hates their worship because it's totally disconnected from how they treat people. God says through Amos, a real relationship with him, with God, will transform a person's relationship with others. And so Amos's call to Israel is to say to them, let justice flow like a river. Let righteousness run like a never-failing stream. Do those words sound familiar to you? Those words were also spoken by the modern-day prophet, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Now, the two words appear in Amos's writing that are very important, and actually they're important throughout the prophets. Righteousness, or in Hebrew, is Wayne here? Tzedakah? I'm not sure how to say this word. Righteousness refers to a standard of right, equitable relationships between people, no matter their social differences. And injustice, mishpat, refers to concrete actions that you take to correct injustice, and to create righteousness. And so both of these terms are supposed to permeate the life of God's covenant people like a rushing stream fills a dry riverbed. And then beginning with chapter 5, there's 4.5 chapters that describe drought, destruction, death, and have lots of woe to you phrases. Woe to you for your religion that is just a show. Woe to you for indulging in luxury while many suffer. Woe to you for worshiping idols, and on and on and on. And then in chapter 8, Amos again revisits the way the wealthy and the powerful are exploiting the poor. Now, many Israelites in Amos's day interpreted their personal success, their standard of living success, their empire's political success as a sign of God's favor. Things were going great for them in Israel. But God wants Amos to say, or wants them to see that, see their society clearly for what it is. And so Amos preaches against this complacency. He preaches against their injustice and social dealings, their reliance on the military, their wealth based on exploitation, their immorality, and their shallow piety. And then again, in the last chapter, Amos announces that Israel will be destroyed. There will be no escape. He says, you thought that God chose you because you were special. You weren't any more special than the godless nations around you. God says, it's my choosing you that made you special. And frankly, you're not the only nation I've helped, so maybe you're not all that special. So you're going to be dispersed. Your temple is going to be destroyed. You will be exiled from this land, no longer a nation, a dispersed people under the thumb of godless nations. Your Exodus experience with me, your chosenness, will not save you. It's horrible. It's really hard to read the prophets. And I know maybe for you, it's raising a lot of questions about the character of God, and it does also did for me. And if those are one of your questions, I'll be happy to talk more about that in the conversation. So there's 9.5 chapters that are basically God's on the way, watch out. Basically, it's 9.5 chapters of change now. But in this last chapter, there's just a couple paragraphs. We see this glimmer of hope. There is this image, that a vision that Amos has. He sees Israel as a destroyed building. But he hears God say that out of the ruins, he is going to restore the house of David. In other words, he is still going to bring this future messianic king from David's line. And God is going to rebuild the family of God's people, which surprisingly in Amos we're told is going to include people from all nations, not just Israel. And all of the devastation caused by Israel's sin will one day be reversed by God. This final paragraph is really important because it is the only sign of hope on the other side of judgment. And it does help us see how this book is exploring the relationship between God's justice and God's mercy. If God is good, he has to confront evil, he has to judge evil, but his long-term goal is to restore the world and build a new covenant family. And so through Amos's words, we still hear God's call today so that we have time to learn from Israel's hypocrisy, Israel's disaster, that we would learn to worship and follow the God who desires justice for all, righteousness for all, shalom for all. It's a tough book to read, and I think the prophet series is going to be a tough but timely series. One of the main things this book, in the week or so I've been working with it, was in teaching me or inspiring me, was to look for the modern day prophets. We have them, and maybe we haven't been listening. One of the interesting and difficult things about prophets is they sound like they're saying no all the time. No, don't do that. Can't do that. Can't do that. But what they're really doing is saying yes to a better way of living. And for many of the modern-day prophets, demonstrating this better way that we are meant to live in the world. And we do know, that modern-day prophets have the same bias toward the bottom, the same bias toward the poor, the same bias toward the weaker and the marginalized that the Old Testament prophets had, which Rohr calls this bias toward the bottom. So I'd like to point out today two modern-day prophets. And one of them is Pope Leo. He did something amazing recently. Pope Leo is, and I don't want to offend anyone. If I do, I'm sorry. But sometimes the gospel is political. There's just no getting around it. Okay, so Pope Leo was invited by our current government to visit the United States and help us celebrate our 250th birthday. But he said no. But he's also making a performative yes act. His yes to God and his demonstration to us of a better way to live is that on July 4th, instead of being here with us in the United States, he's going to be on the island of Lampedusa, a small Italian island that has for years served as a gateway for migrants and refugees traveling to Europe from Africa and the Middle East. It's one of the deadliest stops on the immigration and the migration route. And he is going to be there with them. Another modern-day prophet is Greta Thunberg. She's a Swedish climate change activist. And every action in her life, such as choosing to cross the Atlantic to talk to us in an emission free ship, which to me was very much a performative act. Everything she does is designed to prevent the death of this planet and to educate people on climate change. And when speaking, she sounds very much like a prophet. You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. We are at the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? Bias toward the bottom. And like the Old Testament prophets, she is often vilified. Rohr makes an interesting point about the prophets and what they're saying. And he makes an interesting point about evil. He says that we like to locate evil in individuals. That's a bad person. She's no good. Lock her up. But that there's little value in focusing on a handful of bad actors, because culture and systems are what create the large-scale evils that threaten us, such as poverty, war, ecological devastation. Religion must address collective evil. These are Rohr's words. Nothing will ever change if we merely convert, imprison, or judge a few bad guys. Prophets make us uncomfortable. They make us defensive. They make us even angry. We want to dismiss their words. We label them crazy. We try to sideline them. But we need them. Like the image we saw in the Visio Divina. Is that back? Oh, thank you so much. Prophets insist we see what they see. They force us to see what we don't want to see. They make us conscious of what we don't want to see. In fact, it's their job. As the writer and modern-day prophet James Baldwin said, "If I love you, I have to make you conscious of the things you don't see." Love means paying attention. So, in conclusion, Old Testament prophets, those separated from us by centuries and culture, speak with clarity and relevance into our lives today. They see what is really happening. They're teaching us to pay attention, to be willing to make change. They demand us to see what they see, and their messages challenge us, convict us, sometimes comfort us, urging us to listen for God's voice, urging us to care for our neighbor, for creation, for all people, urging us to live as we've been commanded to live, to love God and to love people. I'm going to close with a benediction written by Kat Armas. Oh, okay. May fear release its grip and pride be surrendered, so our eyes may be open to see the world as it yearns to be. Ignite our imagination with holy curiosity, for truth is a gentle flame ready to burn away the facades. Help us do the work of exposing empire, trusting that in our honest reckoning, we will together find a path toward healing and wholeness. Thanks.